7 seconds.
Six.
Five.
Four.
Three.
Two.
One.
Blast off.
My name's Bob Darrell and I am alcoholic.
Hi, Bob.
Welcome back. I got sober in 1978 at a time in AA when people where I lived were not talking very much about the big book. Everyone was trying to figure out how to apply the steps from the 12 by 12, which is a great book. It's a series of essays about the steps, but unfortunately it's not a set of directions. So it's very confusing. And I tried my first 4 years of sobriety to do several four steps. I did the life story. I did the 30-some questions out of the 12 by 12. And it wasn't until I was a little over 4 years sober that I finally worked the steps out of the book and my life started to really change. And what sustained me in a state of abstinence for my first 4 years was a lot of service and a lot of activity. In Alcoholics Anonymous, I went to 15 meetings a week. I did a lot of 12-step work. I went to hospitals to carry the message. I went into jails to carry the message. I was on a lot of committees. I was on convention committees, roundup committees, as if I could outrun my alcoholism by a lot of activity. And you can for a while. And everybody that I know, every alcoholic I know has a fuse. I had even with a lot of activity in the fellowship, I had a four-year fuse. I've sponsored people. I sponsor a guy now that's 30 years sober who had a 23-year fuse. He was able to stay physically sober without the steps for 23 years.
Wow.
He was a little crazy. Everyone that knew him encouraged him to drink on a regular basis. He just was uptight, miserable guy. But he was sober, damn it. So Jerry had a 23-year fuse. I mean, I think if there was a Guinness Book of World Records on untreated alcoholism, Jerry may get his picture in there one day. But he's doing very, very well today. He's a very happy man. He works the steps. He's free. But in my early sobriety, I was insane. Even going to 15 meetings a week and doing all that service, I'm still nuts from time to time. I still suffer from depression. I'm overwhelmed with bouts of anxiety that are crippling. I would call my sponsor up. It seemed like every other day with a whole new series of, they're not problems. You have problems. I have tragedies. I mean, they say there's no big deals. That's only true for you. So I call my sponsor up and I'd just be nuts. And I'd been thinking deeply. And I'd call him up and I'd say, I say, that job I got, I don't think those people like me. They're looking at me funny. I think they were talking behind my back. I think I'm going to lose that job. Then I won't have a job. Then I won't be able to pay rent. And then I'll be homeless. And I don't know if I can be sober and be homeless. And I'll be living on the streets. And it's not very good out there on the streets. And I don't know what's going to happen to me. And maybe I'll get arrested for vagrancy. And then I'll end up in jail. And I don't know if I can stay sober in jail. And I think I have a brain tumor. And he'd go, whoa. He'd say, listen, is everything okay right this moment? Yeah, but by next week I won't have a job. He says, no, listen, is everything okay right this second? Well, yeah, he said, good. He said, listen, let's hang on to that. When it's no longer okay right this second, he said, you and I are going to have something to work with then. But let's stop solving problems that haven't occurred yet. As Scott has a wonderful saying, let's stop trying to clear up the wreckage of your future. And he's trying to bring me to the only place that you'll ever find God. It talks about it in chapter 5. It's read at every meeting. There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him in a place that alcoholics seldom visit. Now. Now. Even as I'm saying that, you're not here. You're thinking, what page is that on? Who? I can't wait to tell Joe about that. I mean, isn't that clever? You're not even here now when I'm saying that, right? And God is right here, right now. He's the, as it says on page 55, about a third of the way up from the bottom of the page, it says something very amazing. Towards the end of the third full paragraph, it says, we found the great reality deep down within us. And when? In the last analysis. It is only there that he may be found. It is so with us in the last analysis, which means that if you're sober in Alcoholics Anonymous for a number of years and you've looked for power and security and validation everywhere else, you're about par for the course. Because I did that, and a lot of us do that. And we don't do it out of malice. We do it sometimes out of ignorance. My first 4 years of sobriety, I looked for power and I looked for security everywhere else. And it was only after I looked everywhere else and I was at the end of my rope did I do the journey within. Or as Chuck Chamberlain would say, the process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding the things which had been blocking me from the great reality deep down within me. And isn't that what steps 4 through 9 are about? Uncovering, discovering, and discarding. It's we're jettisoning ballast from a balloon that won't take off, that's stuck to the ground. We're getting rid of the things that are blocking us. When I was about three years at the most sober, I was working for an employer who was trying to salvage me as an employee. In my first 4 years of sobriety, I went through 9 jobs. Now that's a picture in itself, right? And it's never my fault. You ever notice how it's never your fault, right? I always get good jobs. It's just I'm not there very long, and they just turn into idiots, and they're stupid, and they're taking advantage of me, and I'm always the guy that's leaving. And I'm working for this guy, and he sees some potential in me, and he gives me a set of tapes to listen to. And it's not AA tapes. They're motivational tapes by a guy named Earl Nightingale. A set of tapes called Lead the Field, and they're designed to take self-centered, unproductive people and light a fire in them and make them more productive. And Earl tells a story on this tape. And when I heard it, it just blew my mind. And he said it was true. And I just was talking to a guy at the break that's going to South Africa. And the story, according to Earl, takes place in South Africa back in the 1800s. And there was this gentleman who had inherited a ranch from his father. And it was a nice ranch, the kind of ranch that he could have sustained a very nice living for him and his family for generations. But the problem was he inherited the ranch during the diamond boom in South Africa, when there were men becoming Bill Gates rich overnight. And the more he heard of their discovery of diamonds and their abundance, the more dissatisfied he became with what he had. And after a while, he got so dissatisfied that he sold his ranch. He took the money from the sale and he went out into the bush, obsessed with striking it rich, obsessed with finding diamonds. I've heard those tapes, I've read 2 accounts of this guy's story. One account was that he never did find any diamonds and he eventually committed suicide. He threw himself into the ocean. Another account that I read said that he just simply died out in the bush, broke, bitter, and alone, and disgusted. And it came to pass, according to Earl Nightingale, that this ranch was sold to these two brothers, and they were developers. And they were clearing some rocks away one day, trying to clear some land and develop some of this ranch. And they found these unusual rocks, and they didn't know what they were. And they took them to a guy, and the guy said, "Well, those are uncut diamonds." And they discovered that this ranch was the largest diamond deposit ever recorded in South Africa. And these two brothers overnight become two of the richest men in the world. And it's an amazing, and they don't know what to do. They have to form this giant company that's going to mine and cut and market and distribute these diamonds all over the world. And one day they're sitting down and they're saying, "We need to name our company something." And the one brother says to the other, he says, "Hey, why don't we name it after that poor SOB that we bought the ranch from? What was his name?" And the other brother says, "Wasn't it De Beers?" And I'm listening to this tape and I'm thinking, "Oh, I'm that idiot. I'm looking everywhere else for what I'm looking for, and it's right with me every single day. Every single day of my life, I go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they read the same thing at every meeting. And these are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. I think I need a motorcycle. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Oh, I need a relationship with her. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need to make more money. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need to buy a house. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need more sponsees. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. I need better meetings. These are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program recovery. There is nothing else suggested. And isn't it odd that a guy like me, only in the last analysis, after I've looked everywhere else for power, for security, and for sustenance, will I take the last lonely journey, the journey through myself to a power greater than myself? Scott?
Thanks, Bob. I love that story. Here are gifts from two friends of mine in my home group. A friend of mine says, "I work this program to the best of my willingness. I've never worked it to the best of my ability." I sit here guilty of that myself. And this is a gift from a lady friend of mine who you've probably heard some of the songs she's written. She reduced what we do to what she calls the four ups: get up, give up, show up, fess up. Pretty well wraps it up. The page 35, I think, asks, and then on page 36 answers one of the great questions. And the question is in the first paragraph, page 35, what sort of thinking dominates, not sort of mildly disconcerts on rare occasion, what sort of thinking dominates an alcoholic who repeats time after time the desperate experiment of the first drink? That's a pretty good question. It gives us a long setup, and the answer actually begins at the top of page 36. It says, "Yet he got drunk again. We asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story." I'd like to observe the difference here. What we asked was, "Tell us exactly what happened." What we got was his story. You understand the difference between what happened and his story? Right, they're not necessarily congruent. And if Bob would take the part of Fred.
Well, I came to work on Tuesday morning.
What happened to Monday? A lot of people work on Monday. Do they work on Monday here? They work on Monday. What happened to Monday? Okay, we missed Monday. All right, go ahead.
I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I had once owned.
Irritated? How about bent? How about your undies are in a permanent wad? How about the veins on your forehead throb when you think about how angry you are about you used to own this place and now you're just a flunky? But please continue with your story.
I had a few words with the boss. Nothing serious.
Oh, you think you had a fight with the boss that wasn't serious? Fights with the boss are, by definition, always serious. There are no exceptions to that whatsoever. But please continue.
So then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car.
Well, that's where they all are. I mean, they never come into the showroom. You just have to go sort of turning over, knocking on doors out in the rural areas. Okay. So here's the kind of thinking we're working with. And then we skip down to the italics to find another thought in that chain.
Suddenly, the thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach.
The exact same kind of thinking. And it's the reason why I need a sponsor. Someone needs to hear this insanity that goes inside my head to help me to say, what do you mean you came to work on Tuesday? What happened on Monday? Etc. And I think it's one of the reasons that I got here with newcomer thinking. Terminal case. I was going to die from it if I didn't get some help with it. Because so many things were running around in here. And my history was, if I think it, I have to do it. Because if I think it, it must be a grand idea. Wasn't necessarily true. Page 60. For the balance of our time together, the perspectives that I'm going to use are how I take a new man through these 12 steps. And an interesting conversation at the break. I take people who are not in AA through these 12 steps. I'm happy to do it for anybody, to give them the basis of what goes on in here to carry it back to another fellowship. And it's something that my mentor told me to do, and I found it to be very beneficial for me. And I like to think they're getting. So if it sounds like I'm telling you what to do, I'm not. This is just how I tell a new man who's asked me to sponsor him to do it. And we begin with the ABCs. A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives. So I ask, that's two parts. So the characteristics of an alcoholic that we describe in the text are, once you begin to drink, you have little control over the amount you take, which is to say you get drunk by accident. Did you ever get drunk accidentally? It didn't really mean to, as his sponsor says, you were carelessly overserved by an irresponsible bartender, something like that, right? Or you quit forever and really mean it this time and don't stay quit. If you have either of those. So I ask him to talk to me about that. Which, do you have either of those? If you have them, tell me some instances about it. Because what we have him doing here is setting his own cornerstones. And I think the longer he talks about those characteristics in himself in detail, the better. And then the second part, could not manage our own lives. What happens when you manage your life? I mean, you're currently not living at home, right? Your key no longer fits in the door, I understand. You got fired from how many? What? Let's talk about what happens when you manage your life. I want to hear it. And then B, probably no human power could have relieved alcoholism. Well, let's talk about who tried. Cops, courts, judges, for example. Psychologists, psychiatrists, parents, siblings, wife, oh, forgive me, wives. Who tried to relieve your alcoholism? And given the fact that those people, some of them, at least theoretically, well qualified, were unable to relieve it, and I'll tell you now, I can't. Is it logical to deduce that no human power will be able to in the future? And we talk about that. And then I like to go to page 12. And I believe, as I said earlier, that when the text gives me something twice, it's terribly important. This, for me, is one of the absolute foundation stones of this thing that we do here. And it's a gift from Ebbie Thatcher, who was sober only a few months. And he called his friend Bill Wilson and came to visit him. Slightly above the center of the page, my friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, why don't you choose your own conception of God? We have very little interest in what you actually think you believe. You're probably confused about what you think you believe. We have no interest in that. We have no interest in what they told you about God. And I don't care how qualified they claim to be. We're asking you to choose. Page 93. Four lines down from the top of page 93. Stress the spiritual feature freely. If the man be agnostic or atheist, make it emphatic. He does not have to agree with your conception of God. Here it comes. He can choose any conception he likes, provided it makes sense to him. So twice we've told you, we've invited you to choose a conception of God. I got here terrified that there might be a God. I am guilty as charged. And when I was a child, well, Mama, why did Grandma die? Well, it was God's will. It sounds dangerous to me. And so I quote my wife, who's in the other room, who says, God's will is a good deal. See, I got here not believing that. I was afraid there might be a God. And so I need to get a God that, as she says, is bigger than all the monsters under the bed. I've got to have a God whose hand I can confidently hold as I walk into what appear to be the dark cave of steps 4 and 5. And it actually isn't once you've been in there, but from the outside looking in, it's terrifying. Probably the easiest steps we have. A little bit on the long side, but quite easy. And we're going to talk about that in these next few sessions. So I've got to have a God that works for me. So I tell him, we're going to now sit down and design a God that will work for you. What characteristics would you like for God to have? Because we're asking you to choose. And I ask them to use single words or short phrases. And let's write them down. And I tell them that I will, as we do this, I'm going to make some suggestions. If I suggest something and you like it, write it down. If I suggest something and you don't like it, don't take it. Don't let me sell this to you. This is what would you like God to be? And they usually start out with forgiving. And I tell them that was insufficient for me. I'm a little bit too guilty for forgiving. I needed a God that was eager to forgive. Just forgiving was short. And that's just for me. But if forgiving, you want that, then fine, write it down. Powerful, how about all powerful? Gentle, loving. How about has a sense of humor? I want a God that laughs. I want a God that laughs. I mean, this is the God that invented the duckbill platypus. I mean, come on. Does he not have a sense of humor? Right. And a God who wants what's best for me. And how about this? A God that's available to me anytime. How about creative? And so we write these things down. And then I say to him, I'm not going to ask you to believe this. I don't think you can. All my life, religious people say, believe this. Well, how? Well, just believe it. Well, how? Well, they can't tell me, and I can't tell you either. This is another gift from my home group. Faith is simply hope with a track record. You can have hope. You see this working for so many of us. Clearly, you can hope. And once you've hoped for a while and done what we do, that hope will evolve into faith. So I'm not asking you to believe this. I'm going to ask you to do what the scientists call a working hypothesis. And what that means is we have reason to believe something may be true. We're going to apply it in all cases and find out what happens. Simple enough. So what I'm going to ask you is, how would you conduct yourself, best you can figure, if you believed this is what God was? Conduct yourself that way and let's find out what happens. Not asking you to believe it. But I'm asking you simply, how would you conduct yourself if you believe that? Let's do that and see what happens. Page 60. C, that God could and would if he were sought. Well, God could. We've got him down as all powerful, so I'd say he could do about anything. And would. Well, let's see. He's eager to forgive me. He loves me. He has a sense of humor. He's available to me, so I'd say he would. And I think it's so powerful. The language I don't believe in this book is by mistake. If he were sought. It doesn't say if he were found. Item one, God is not lost. Does not have to be found. But simply sought. I like the analogy that God is rather like the mother of a four-year-old playing hide and seek with her child. Where does she hide? She hides where the child can find her. Right? All he has to do is seek. This is my heavenly parent who has hidden where I can find him, if only I will seek. Page 57. I love this part of the work so much. Very top of page 57. Save for a few brief moments of temptation, the thought of drink has never returned, and at such times a great revulsion has risen up in him. Seemingly he could not drink even if he would. God had restored his sanity. I find two places in the book, and I'm going to give you the page number. Please don't turn to it. We're going to stay right here. It's also mentioned on pages 84 and 85, where they promise me sanity. But I can't find a place in this book, and I've read it a couple of times, that promises me manageability. My life does not become more or less manageable. It remains unmanageable by me, period. I have fired me as general manager of my own life. based on my performance. Yeah, a good, right? A good manager would have fired me decades ago. And one of the first things I did when I woke up this morning is I invited God in to run my life today. Not give me some help and I'll take it from here. Not here's your, I always wanted to be God's coach. Big fella, take a knee. You know, and here's your assignment for today. And what about that lottery ticket? And all of that stuff. And I was literally trying to be God's coach. And what I have learned is in those days when I did pray, as I said last night, the pre-AA prayers, help me pass this test I didn't study for. Please don't let her be pregnant. And God, get me out of this and I'll never do it again. Those are the pre-AA prayers in my experience. That those times when I did pray, I was trying to make him my God. And what they've taught me here is how to make me his man. The difference is that this one works. But I don't find a place that promises me manageability. I'm not going to get to manage it. I don't want to manage it anymore. I've seen what happens when I manage it. I don't know how much more that I could survive. I don't want what I want anymore. I want what God wants me to have. I don't know what it is. I know how to get it. And it's by doing the things you've taught me each day. And by that definition, I have it right now. What a gift it is for me to be here in Scotland with you. This is what I get when I simply try to be a tool in his hand. That's my job. So here on page 57, we're promising sanity. It says, what is this but a miracle of healing? Yet its elements are simple. Circumstances made him willing to believe. Or in a case like mine, that means I worked myself into a crack I couldn't lie my way out of. It says, he humbly offered himself to his maker, then he knew. It doesn't say he asked for a little help. Get me out of this and I'll never do it again. He said, take me. He signed carte blanche. It means white paper. It means I signed the bottom of the rest of my life and held it up to God and say, whatever you want to fill in on this suits me, fine. I'm not asking any questions about it. There's a story that came out of the Pacific at the end of World War II. Douglas MacArthur was the commanding officer of the Allied forces. He met on the battleship Missouri to accept the surrender from the Japanese delegation. They're all in their formal regalia. And the lead, and I do not know who it was, of the Japanese delegation in his tuxedo with all his stuff on it, walked up to the surrender documents and began to read. MacArthur said to him, don't read it, just sign it. Yeah, you're beat, just sign it. That's where I am. I'm beat. I'm signing it. That's what we're talking about here. We're no longer, I was always afraid I worked God too hard. I'll tell you what, I'll cover sex and money. He can get the rest. I don't believe that's the package. Continuing on page 57, he humbly offered himself to his maker. Then he knew. Even so has God restored us all to our right minds. To this man, the revelation was sudden. Some of us grew into it more slowly. Here's a promise. But he has come to all who have honestly sought him. When we drew near to him, he disclosed himself to us. What a powerful, powerful set of promises. Continuing on page 60, and I've wished for a long time that when we read this portion of chapter 5, we'd pick up this next phrase. It says, being convinced we were at step 3. Convinced of what? How about A, B, and C? Are A, B, and C true for you? Welcome to step 3. It's that hard. Which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood him. In the short form of the step, it says over to the care of God. When I use the phrase short form of the step, I'm talking about what you see on the wall here. The expanded form is kind of a lot deeper. And I don't have an editorial on that. It's just, I just happened to notice it. But I do observe this. Step 3 is not where we turn our will and life over to God or over to the care of God. Clearly not. It's where we decide to. I learned this from Bob at one of these sessions a couple of years ago. The word decision comes from the Latin word scissore, which means to cut. It's the same root word as the word for scissors or incision. A decision is when I cut away the other options and act on the one that I have decided. So if at step 3 I decide to turn my will and life over to God or over to the care of God, whichever you prefer, then the question becomes, how do I accomplish that decision? And I believe the answers are numbered 4 through 12. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result, spiritually awakened people have done all they can to turn their will and lives over to the care of God. And that for me, that ties it all together. My sponsor explained it this way. He said there are 3 frogs sitting on a log in the middle of a lake. 2 decide to jump into the water. How many does that leave on the log? And I said, 1. And he said, no, 3. They've just decided. They haven't jumped yet. So 3 is where I decide to jump. 4 is where I begin the jump. Continuing on page 60. Just what do we mean by this, and just what do we do? The first requirement, aha, there are requirements. And there must be more than one if there's a first. The first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. And I ask that as a question. Are you convinced? Not just your life, but any life. That's universal. Have you ever seen one? My family likes to watch reality television. We watch The Apprentice as a family. And I've been watching Donald Trump for 3 or 4 years. And I'd like to trade wallets with him. But I've never seen him smile. I mean, I've seen his lips do what appears to be one. But I don't see him smile. That doesn't look like a success to me. Financial success, I'm certain that it is. But this is the kind of success I need. And I've never seen someone with this kind of success in here that was run on self-will. Have you? Let's talk about it. And as a new guy, I want, let's talk about that. This is a requirement. And then it says, on that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Collision. Bam. Bent metal. Broken glass. Blood. Screaming. That's collision. That's different from like mild disagreement on rare occasion. Collision. And it says, even though our motives are good. See, I've been hearing people in meetings for 23 years say, check your motives. And here it says very clearly, that won't work. A lot of the popular things we hear in meetings don't hold. One of my favorites is no major decisions the first year. I look at that third step. If that's not a major decision, I wouldn't know which way to turn out of the driveway to go to look for one. Are we telling a woman who's getting beaten up 4 nights a week by a drunken husband not to make a decision? That holds no water whatsoever. I need to get off that soapbox. But this thing about motives is important to me. And I learned this lesson. I was sober a couple of years. And I'm a sales rep. And I call on major accounts in the U.S. selling merchandise. There was a particular purchasing agent at a major account who represented about a third of my income. And I was making a lot of money in those days. And he could have easily doubled or tripled how much he bought from me. We were personal friends. Our wives are friends. We're guests in each other's homes. We have spiritual discussions, never a religious one. He was an amazing guy. And I get a phone call from him one day, and he said, we're at Vanderbilt Hospital. My wife has just given birth 2 months early, and the news is not good. Would you come down here and pray over this child? I said, you bet. And I got in the car, and I drove down to that hospital doing what I'd been told. I'm checking my motives, and I can't answer the question. I don't know if I'm going down to pray over that child to bring spiritual help to this family or to get close to this guy so he'll put more money in my pocket. I can't find my motive. And I did what you taught me. I prayed about it. And this is what I believe. When I can't get an answer, one of two things is in place. Either I've asked the wrong question. And by the way, the right question on the wrong day, still the wrong question. Yeah. Or it's okay that I make a mistake here so that I can get a lesson, or so that someone else can maybe watch me who couldn't have gotten the lesson. Because I signed the carte blanche. I said, you can fill this in any way you want to. All the lessons aren't for me. And so anyway, I prayed and I said, God, I need some help here. I can't answer a question. And I'm not going to ask you to believe what I'm about to tell you came from God. I want you to know that I believe it. And the next thing I got was a very clear question in my mind. And the question was, does going into a hospital to pray over a sick child violate any of your principles? And the answer was, no, it doesn't. There are no wrong reasons for doing the right thing. There are likewise no right reasons for doing the wrong thing. And that's what motive is about. Motive is one of the ways I play God. When I operate from motive, I'm trying to govern the outcome. When I operate from principle, I'm doing what God, I think he wants me to do. I'm leaving the outcome in his hands. I don't get God's ends using Satan's means. I give you an example. These two married people feel like they've lost the spark in their relationship. They both have excellent jobs. Their kids both play in a high school band. They have plenty of extra money. They have plenty of vacation time. They both decide to take a Thursday afternoon off and spend it in a Holiday Inn, a motel, to try to, and the kids have a safe ride home, to try to recap. Their motive is to recapture the spark from their early relationship. I think everybody here would say that's a good motive, right? Everybody good with that? So we're probably in pretty good ground here. Oh, did I leave out the detail that they're not married to each other? Did I miss that? Did I forget that? Okay. I am fully capable of that kind of thinking. I am fully capable of that. And that's why I have to operate from principle rather than motive. But that's what it says here. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. I have to get out of the motive business. It doesn't matter what my motive. I had a guy, every man in my home group has sponsored this guy a couple of times. And he was back one more time. And there was a young lady had just moved to Nashville from out of state. And partway through the meeting, he leaned over to me and he said, I think I'm going to get a map of the city and mark some of the better meetings for this lady and give it to her so she'll be able to get a good start here in town. She was sober about 6 years. And I said, well, I think that's a really good idea. Why don't you give it to the guy that moved in from out of state, also in the meeting? He hadn't thought of that. Yeah. So I got to get out of the, he had a good motive, right? I got to get out of the motive business. I get in lots of trouble. I'm going to skip a lot of things here and leave them for Bob, but I want to skip to something at the bottom of page, on page 62. My sponsor said to me, I'm about to give you the best news you're ever going to get in your whole life. I said, really? He said, yeah, it's right here on page 62. I said, are you ready for some great news? I said, I am. He said, here it is. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. Was that it, Jerry? Yeah, that was it. I don't get it. He said, that's the best news you're ever going to get, man. Because if it really is, the cops, the courts, the judges, the blacks, the Chinese, the Russians, and the ex-wife, if it really is them, you're cooked. Because we can't do anything about them. The good news is that you are the problem. And if you'll bring some willingness to this party, we can work on it. You know, he was right. I think that might be the best news I ever got. I'm the problem. And I'll bring the willingness to the party, we can work on that. Pretty powerful stuff. In that paragraph, it tells me twice that I can't reduce my last sentence in that paragraph. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. It actually says that twice in that paragraph. On the fourth line, it says above everything. I wonder if that's important. Above everything. That's somewhere right in the middle, right? It's above everything. We must be rid of the selfishness. And yet I can't do that myself. In the next paragraph, it says, this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. And I had the privilege of sitting with one of my mentors. I actually had him trapped in a hotel lobby for about 4 hours one morning. And I asked him a lot of questions. And finally, at one point, he said, let me ask you a question. I thought, okay, here's my chance to shine. And he said, on page 62, you agreed to quit playing God. I said, yes. He said, how'd you play God? I said, I don't know. And he said, here are some of the ways I played God. I became angry when someone died. And that's me saying I know who should die and how and when. And that is me playing God. Another one is that I tried to manage my own life and the lives around me. And the closer you were to me, the harder I tried to manage your life. Another one is that I judged people. And the way I know that is I had resentments. And there's only one way to get a resentment. You must judge someone, find them guilty, be angry with them, and then feel that anger again. That's what resent means. It from the Latin, re means again, like reread, and sentire means to feel. So it is feeling again of old anger. That's what resentment is. He said, I had resentments. I must have judged. It's the first step toward a resentment. Here's some that I have added for myself since then, is that I trusted my motives. When I operate from motive, I'm playing God. I know how this should turn out. And so I am playing God when I trust my motives. Another one is that I needed to know. When I ask the question why, I'm playing God again. It's me needing to know, and it makes me crazy. Another one is that I was absolutely sure that all the things that I knew for sure were correct, and anyone who disagreed with me was clearly a fool. Boy, that's not only playing God, but it blocks my learning process completely. And another one is that I told lies. When I lie, I'm really playing God because I'm managing an outcome. That's precisely what it is. Quite a bit left on step three. I'm going to turn it over to Bob.
And Bob's still an alcoholic. Thank you, Scott. Great, great stuff. On the bottom of page 60 and the top of 61, Bill uses an analogy. An analogy when I could see myself in it, all of a sudden I started to understand what must be surrendered. Because we're really in the section on step three, which is we made a decision to turn, first of all, our will, and second of all, our lives over to the care of God. And what are we surrendering? And Bill uses the analogy in the bottom of 60 and 61 where he compares us to an actor who wants to run the whole show. And if you've ever been part of a play, imagine just one of the members of the cast, not the star, not the headliner, just a member of the cast, and he's trying to tell the other actors how they should say their parts. He's trying to tell the dancers how they should dance. He's trying to tell the stagehands how they should set the stage. He's trying to tell the director how he should direct. He's trying to tell the lighting people how they should work the lights. He's probably saying, you know, you need the spotlights more on me. And if you've ever been around a person like that, they're a pain in the butt. Right? They really are. And my sponsor in early sobriety had me read this part of the book over and over again. And I could not see how this was me. But I could see how it was a lot of people in AA. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And I couldn't wait to tell them. But there's a line in the 12 by 12. It says that we are quick to see our defects of character in others before we can see them in ourselves. And I could see that you were like the actor. I could see that you were self-centered. You were controlling. You were trying to run the show. But I can't see that in me, because when I'm doing the exact same thing, I'm not trying to run the show. I'm trying to make things nice here. This would be great. See, you're trying to control things. I'm just trying to make things right. And I can't see that I'm doing that. Until I had one of those bad days. You know, one of those bad days where nothing's going your way and all the customers at work are very demanding and they want attention. And the people in traffic are not driving right. And the people in AA are not acting right. And I'm just up to here ready to explode. My sponsor says, read page 60 through 63. And for the first time in my life, I could see that it was me. And I could see what they meant when they said selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. It is what the self is what must be surrendered, is what must be abandoned. Harry, the great psychiatrist Harry Thibault, who worked with Bill Wilson for a number of years, used another analogy. And he took part of it from Sigmund Freud and he expanded it. He talked about in a thing that he wrote called Ego Factors in Surrender in Alcoholism, he said that what must be surrendered in the alcoholic, he equated it to His Majesty the Baby, Divine Ruler of the Universe. And when you think about it, it's no wonder guys like me are so intolerant of others and so judgmental. Because I know that others shouldn't act that way in the royal presence. And why I'm so impatient, I think secretly it's beneath my station to wait like other people. I want the king, baby, wants immediate gratification. And that, what a hideous analogy. And yet it seemed to fit me pretty well. In the middle of page 61, it talks about the delusion, and Scott touched on this. I think as long as I'm a victim, right about two lines down from the square in the middle of the page, it says, is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? As long as I come at life from the delusion that I can fill my vacancies, that I can wrest happiness and satisfaction out of this world by my managing, I will never, ever be satisfied and happy. The best I will ever get is moments of instant gratification that are very short-lived, like a flash in the pan, and then back to the desolation and vacancy of me. And that seems, it always seems to be that way. You know, a lot of my life, I would go into periods of abstinence, wanting to be sober and thinking I need to be happy in order to be sober. So I'll be happy if I have this. Oh, yeah, yeah, this, and I get this. That's not it. Oh, it's this. Oh, yes, this is, I get this. That's not it either. I heard a story years ago of this woman from Corpus told this story. It was a wonderful about some of her relatives, she spent Christmas with them, and they were very well-to-do. And they had a little three-year-old kid who they were spoiled a little bit. They would overindulge. And they got this kid 28 Christmas presents under the tree Christmas morning. And this kid got up and started opening these presents. Oh, wow. And then he went to the next one. Oh, wow. And next one. He tears through 28 presents, tearing the wrapping off him. And after he gets through the last one, he sits on the floor and he's kicking his hands and feet and he's crying, I didn't get what I wanted. And they said, well, what did you want? I don't know, but I didn't get what I wanted. Right? Oh, do I get that? Oh, man. I don't know what it is, but I didn't get it. You know, do I get that? A victim of an illusion. And that's why it's a delusion. Because if I could actually fill my holes, if I could actually rest happiness and satisfaction, my God, wouldn't I have done it by now? I don't know a demographic on the planet that has ever spent more money, more time, and more obsessive energy and focus on trying to make themselves happy and satisfied as we have, and the end result is some of us wished we were dead. Absolute failure at managing my own life, at resting happiness and satisfaction. So if you really connect the dots and you get it, that is a dead-end street, then wouldn't it make perfect sense to throw up your hands and stop? Stop trying and try to do something different. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is trying to get me to do, is make a shift in my approach to life, away from a life of self, me, gratification, self-satisfaction, self-happiness, self, to maybe a life of serving something other than myself, an ethic, a purpose, a set of principles. Maybe I'm trying to move from self-centered to other-centered, to self-reliance, to God-reliant, a life driven by self-centered fear to a life motivated by love. What a shift. When they say that Alcoholics Anonymous is a 180-degree turn, they're not kidding. It is a completely different direction than anything I've ever done in my whole life. I don't know about you guys, but I just thought about me, worried about me, wondered about me. I'd get so tired of worrying about me, I'd have to ask you, so what do you think of me? I mean, it just... Right. I used to love AA. I used to love discussion meetings in early sobriety. I'd go to a meeting and take the whole meeting hostage on one of my problems. Just, let's get everybody in the room thinking about the most important thing in the universe. Bob, come on. Right? I never came out of a meeting like that feeling better. I always felt worse. And I don't think the people in the meeting felt that much better either. So I'm a victim of this delusion. The bottom of page 61, Bill gives several examples. And he starts it off with equating something that I never understood until I saw him equated here. He says, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. So that self-centered and ego-centered are the same thing. Chuck Chamberlain said one time, if it wasn't for the ego, we wouldn't even need Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the thing that must be surrendered. Self, ego, that part of me that wants to play God. You know the part of you that walks into a strange room of people and just starts judging them? The part that wakes up in the morning and starts worrying about you? That is what I must abandon. I must get my life out of its hands. When I was early in sobriety, a guy said to me, he said, you got to take step three. And I said, Joe, I don't think I can. I don't know if there's a God or not. And he pointed to a chair and he said, listen, kid, if you'll turn your will and your life over to that chair, I promise you an instantaneous miracle. I said, okay, Joe, I turned my will and my life over to the chair. What's the miracle? He says, well, kid, the miracle would be your life would no longer be in the hands of an idiot. I didn't even get my feelings hurt. I just thought, yeah, that'd be right. Yeah. Because if you'd have followed me around, not just drunk, but drunk and early sobriety, as anybody may have watched you, your family maybe, it'd be easy to come to the conclusion that whoever's making decisions for this guy is out to destroy him. And yet, as I went through jobs and relationships and I hurt people, I never understood that I was doing that. That's why some of us feel like victims by the time we get here. We don't know why life has been turning on us. But on the top of page 62, it starts to explain it. But these examples that he gives on the bottom of 61, the top of 62, of the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and it talks about the retired businessman lolling in the Florida sunshine, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister sighing over the sins of the 20th century. What do all those positions that he's talking about, those examples, have in common? Aren't they sitting in a state of separation from their fellows through their own judgment, through their own playing God? You can feel the judgment in the separation in the sentence, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, the politicians and reformers who were sure all would be utopia if you would only behave. Isn't it the separation through judgment? And I think alcoholism is a disease of separation that centers in the will. And is not the will the judgment? I went to an attorney to make a will years ago for my estate. And he said, the guy was not in AA, and it was an off-the-hand remark. He said to me, well, when you make your last will, aren't you really making your last judgment? You're going to judge these people to be idiots so they don't get anything. You're going to judge these people to be cool so they get something. Isn't it your last judgment? And I thought, that's right, it is. I'm judging that I love my daughter, so I'm giving her this. And I'm judging these friends, I love them, I'm going to give them something. I'm judging I don't like these people, they don't get nothing. That's my last judgment. I've revisited a lot of the religion of my childhood in the light of the awakening that has occurred within me as a result of these steps. And in the light of this awakening, all of a sudden, a lot of the things I was told as a child in church started making a different kind of sense. I started looking at them a little differently. I couldn't get a lot of that stuff when I was a kid. It didn't make sense to me. But one of the things I revisited was the story in Genesis of Adam and Eve. Now, I am not a biblical scholar. And so what I'm about to share with you is only my perception in the light of this spiritual awakening. But it occurred to me in this story of Adam and Eve that I might have had it all wrong. That when it talks about in the Bible, God creating this paradise on earth, this thing called the Garden of Eden, that it was pretty much like a heaven on earth. And he gave it to Adam and Eve, and they were free to do anything they wanted. They were happy living there. He made one suggestion. The suggestion was, do not eat of the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know, kind of like your sponsor makes a suggestion, don't go with her. You know, you didn't even want to he said that. You know, it's... right. You didn't even notice her until he said that. And, oh, yeah, her. Oh, what's he know? You know, so they said, thou shalt not. And all of a sudden, that tree looked pretty good, I guess. And they ate the fruit from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You know what I think happened? I don't think externally in reality anything changed. But I think they got the knowledge of good and evil. And all of a sudden they got the judgment. And what had once been heaven, all of a sudden wasn't so hot anymore. And Adam's thinking, God, there's flies, there's crabgrass. What were you thinking? God, Eve's got cellulite. What were you thinking? This isn't heaven. This is terrible. And what had changed? Nothing except their perception. One of my mentors, a guy named Chuck Chamberlain, used to tell a story about coming off a drunk, and he was about a day sober, and he felt awful. He was sitting depressed in this chair, living in this house, married to that woman, working at that place, and he felt like he wanted to die. He felt like he was in hell. Years later, he was sitting in the same chair, in the same house, married to the same woman, with the same kids, working in the same place, and he had tears in his eyes because he felt like he was in heaven. And he said, what had changed? He said, nothing. He said, maybe heaven's just a new pair of glasses. What am I surrendering here? I'm surrendering the thing that has kept me out of paradise all my life. It is my judgment. I will tell you something that I know as I know I'm sitting here. I've had a lot of situations in my life that have been horrible and terrible and painful. Not one of them was horrible, terrible, or painful. It was my judgment of what was going on that made me nuts. When I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous, I would have told you this is the worst thing that could happen to a bright, sensitive guy like me. And it turned out to be the best thing that ever happened to me. When my first wife and I got a divorce, I told my sponsor, this is horrible. This is the worst thing that's ever happened to me. And you know what he kept saying to me? He kept smiling and saying, oh, you're going to see, this is the best thing that ever happened to you. And I used to think, what is he? Is he smoking something? And he was right. The only thing that was causing me pain and torment was my judgment of what was going on. What was going on was wonderful. Was wonderful. It was my judgment. So if I could surrender my will, if I could actually let it go and turn it over to God, then life would be perfect. It is my judgment that makes things imperfect. Page 62. The first full paragraph is a vision of what we'll find in step three, in step four. It says selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Underneath your job problems, underneath your family problems, underneath your relationship problems, underneath your obsession with alcohol, those of you that have developed a little gambling problem, eating disorders, fears and anxieties, depression, isn't underneath everything one grandfather obsession of them all? Aren't you first and foremost obsessed with yourself, your feelings, your security, your well-being, how I'm doing? Isn't that the grandfather obsession of them all? Everything else is just a form of gratifying self. My fears of losing my job is just worried about me. My fear of my depression is because, you know what depression is? That's when God stops doing your will. Right? And the anxiety of not getting my way, isn't it all come back to selfishness, self-centeredness? The book says we think that is the root of our troubles. It sure was for me. Every single thing. The loneliness. came because I never felt like I fit out here, because self-centered people don't even exist out here. I exist up here, disconnected from life itself. And it says driven, and I love that word driven. I kind of felt driven when I got sober. You know, I had that edge to me. You know, one of the things that's happened to me in AA is that for the most part, on a good spiritual hair day, Alcoholics Anonymous has turned me from a type A to a type B personality. I'm not that insane running around like with my hair on fire guy that I was when I first got sober. I was a driven kind of guy, smoking 4 packs of cigarettes a day. Just up, just on that edge all the time. I'm not that guy anymore. Driven by 100 forms of fear, worry, guilt, shame, remorse, apprehension, anxiety, self-concern, 100 forms of fear. 100 forms of self-delusion. That psychotic wishful thinking, where I try to argue with reality. It's not that, my sponsor says something interesting. He says it's not that alcoholics can't see reality. We can see it. We just don't like it. You know, we want it to be something other than what it is. And we want it to be something other than what it is so badly that I start imagining that it is something other than what it is. Maybe you've had relationship problems where you're with someone you shouldn't be with. But you won't want to be alone so badly you start imagining this is the person you need to be with. And then you get mad at them because they're not the person you think they should be. Who's the idiot in that equation? Right? Who's the idiot in that equation? When they were never anything other than what they were. And I'm expecting them to be something that I imagine is going to fill my vacancies. They were never designed to do that. Driven by self-seeking. And the last one is the hardest one to see, self-pity. What a hideous emotion. I think that the two most hideous human defects or emotions are self-pity and envy and jealousy. You know, do you ever hate someone in your home group because they got a really nice car? And you don't even want to admit that you hated them for that because it's such a childish thing, you know? Or someone comes to the meeting and they're doing very well and they want to share their big success with everyone and then you get depressed. Right? Oh, it's a hideous one. And self-pity's the worst of all. It's so bad that I don't even want to admit to myself that I'm driven by it at times. And yet, I don't know why. I was a depressive. I'd been diagnosed as clinically depressed. I like the term depression. It sounds better than self-pity. Depression is something that people can go, oh, you're depressed, oh. But nobody will say that when you're feeling sorry for yourself. It's such a hideous thing. It's terrible. There's a guy in my home group, early sobriety, has a big house up on the hill with tennis courts. Very generous man, has a lot of open house parties. And he invited everybody from my home group there. Everybody's excited. All day Sunday, they're going to have this party. They're going to have a band and a lot of food, and it's going to be great. I sat Friday night before the Sunday party. I'm at my home group, and he made the announcement that it was an open house. But then I watched him walk across the meeting and personally invite someone. And he never did that to me. And I'm a thinker. And I knew in no time at all that he didn't really want me there. Sunday morning, so I've decided I'm not going to go. I'm not going to go where I'm not wanted. A friend of mine from my home group calls me up and says, hey, you going up to Dick's? No, I don't think I will. Well, why not? I just don't feel like they really want me up there. He says, what are you talking about? It's an open house. Everybody's invited. Of course you want you up there. You're a member of the home group. Of course they want you up there. No, I don't think so. Well, everybody's going to be there. We're going to have a good time. You got to come. No, you go ahead without me. Don't worry about me. I'm going to stay home and watch a rerun of Gilligan's Island. isn't that hideous? That is just so pathetic. And yet, as a depressive, that's the stuff that goes on inside of me that I don't even want to tell anybody about because it's so childish and so pathetic that I could allow my emotions to be so consumed with myself and my judgments and what I think you're thinking that I would do that to myself repeatedly, repeatedly. So I'm driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And driven by those things, it alters my angle of approach to life. And consequently, driven by those things, I sometimes step on the toes of my fellows and they retaliate. The problem is that I don't know that I'm doing that. I can't see past myself to see what I must look like to you. See, that's the problem, is I can never see me the way that you see me. Because if I could see me the way that you could see me, I would really get why you react to me the way you do. But see, I don't have a clue because I can't see the whole picture. I can't see past myself. And so they retaliate because I've stepped on their toes. Don't know I did, but I did. Sometimes they hurt me. The book says seemingly without provocation. That means like seemingly without any reason. Like I don't know why they're doing this to me after all I've done for them. And then here's what it says we'll find in step four. That we had made decisions that sometime in the past we have made decisions based on self. Self-centered, self-seeking, self-centered fear, self-pity. Made decisions based on self, making me better, resting satisfaction and happiness out of this world by managing well. Made decisions based on self, which later placed me in that position to be hurt. And like Scott said, so the good news is our troubles we think are basically of our own making. There's tremendous hope in that. Because as long as it's your fault, I'll never get you straightened out enough for me to be okay. I'll get some of you straightened out, but there'll always be one SOB will turn on me and ruin the whole day. But if the truth is that I am the one that must become different, that I am the one that must change, and that there is a power greater than myself that if I can bring myself surrendered to the table, can make those changes, then the hope is that I can become different enough that I can be happy and satisfied. It won't be from making you right, so I'll be good. It'll be my changing this. That I could change myself into becoming the person that's happy. And isn't that what I did with 5 shots of tequila? 5 shots of tequila would wrest a lot of happiness and satisfaction out of this world at one time for me. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They're basically of my own making. And this process of uncovering, discovering, and discarding is to let go of the things that are blocking me. One of my favorite TV shows that I saw when I was a little kid, in the United States there used to be a show on TV called Rescue 8. And it was about these 2 firemen, these 2 paramedics, and they would go in this truck out to help people that were in trouble, they were trapped in cars or all kinds of things. And there was this one episode where these 2 guys that star in the show were in the truck and they're out on a call. And there's a little tiny girl with her arm stuck in a vending machine. And she can't get it out. And they're pulling equipment. They're pulling saws and torches off this truck. They're going to cut the door off the truck to free this little girl who's crying and she's scared and stuck. And as they're setting up the equipment to cut the door, The one fireman's looking at her, and he's got this funny look on his face, and he says to her, he says, "Sweetheart, do you have something in your hand?" And she goes, "Uh-huh." He says, "Do you have a candy bar in your hand?" And she says, "Yeah." He says, "Sweetheart, you must let go of the candy bar. No, no, it's my candy bar. I won't let go of the candy bar. He says, sweetheart, you have to let go of the candy bar. I won't let go of the candy bar. And he says to her, he says, sweetheart, I promise you that if you let go of the candy bar, I will get you two candy bars. And isn't that what we observe in AA to the people who let go, that they get better than they ever got from holding on? And she finally trusts him enough to let go. And the minute she lets go of the candy bar, her arm slides out of the vending machine and she is free. What's your candy bar? In step four, we're going to look at what you're holding on to. What are the judgments, the old ideas, the things within you that are keeping you locked into you, locked into the center? On middle of page 63 are the formal terms of surrender. I'm going to read this prayer. It's in the second paragraph. If you want to read it along with me, please feel free. It says, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. And then it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we're ready. Well, too late. Sorry. It's too late. When I was in my first year of sobriety, I got down on my knees with another member of AA and I said this prayer out loud. And I thought I knew what I was doing and I didn't have a clue. The next 10 months of my sobriety were the most difficult and crazy and insane I've ever been on. Within no time at all, I lost the job I had, a job that I thought was going to be my lifelong career. And I could not get another job in that field anywhere. I put resumes everywhere. Every door was closed. I'm fearing homelessness. My roommate moves out. Now, even with a job and a roommate to split the bills, I could barely make it paycheck to paycheck. Now I have no job and no roommate to help with the bills. Homelessness is coming at me. My girlfriend leaves. Dumps me. I started going through these weird emotional displacements, undescribable stuff, crazy stuff. I'd just be sitting having a cup of coffee, and all of a sudden this well of emotion would start coming out. I just start sobbing. And it didn't come out pretty, and I didn't understand it. Where was this coming from? I told my sponsor, I said, I'm getting worse. He said, oh, no, you're right on track. I thought, right for what? A train wreck? What are you talking about? And you see, when I took the third step prayer, God took what I said more serious than I did. And he started building with me and doing with me. And just like an abandoned building that you're going to rehab, you have to tear a lot of stuff out in order to make room for something new. And the problem is that God never asked for my seal of approval on any of it. He never showed me the plans. If he'd have showed me the plans, then he would have said, well, Bob, we got to get you out of that job. That's not a good job for you, Bob. I don't think you're going to stay sober in that job. We're going to get you out of that job so we can get you over here. So one day you're going to own your own company and you're going to be set for life financially and never have to worry about money. And you're going to live a very abundant lifestyle and own several houses. And it's going to be really, really good. Would that be okay for you, Bob? But God didn't say that. He just took the job, right? If he had said, well, we got to get this girl out of your life, Bob, because she's going to drink in about 6 months, and the guy with her is going to drink with her. That could be you. I'd say, oh, get her gone. Get her gone. That roommate, we got to get him out of there because there's a guy from Florida going to be moving into town in a couple months, and he's going to look to share an apartment with someone. And you and him are going to be roommates, and you're going to do a lot of 12-step work together, and it's going to take your program to a new level. Would that be okay for you, Bob? Yeah. And these emotions that are coming out of you, they've been blocking you up, Bob. They've been jamming you up. It's like emotional constipation. We got to get that stuff out of you. Would that be okay for you, Bob? Because you're going to get free? And I would have said, yeah. But God didn't tell me any of that stuff. He just started building with me and doing with me. And everything he took away had to go. And what was the problem? The problem was not what he was taking. The problem was my self-centered, fear-based judgment of what was going on. That was the problem. There really wasn't a problem. There never was. The problem was my judgment.
If I'm going to actually walk this thing, I'm not going to get what I want. I'm going to have to settle for quite a bit more. Yeah, right. We're going to take a 1 hour and 13 minute break.